So hello everyone. What we forgot to say when we were recapping what has happened before is that everything we said was based on this book called This Being That Becomes, and it's going to be officially launched next week. The author of the book is coming here to also give a talk. I said it's based on this book, but actually this book is based on what the Buddha said. And so what we're exploring here is what is probably the core teaching of the Buddha. And one way of expressing it is that everything that happens, happens because of conditions. So you're talking about everything being condition in the sense of there are things that are there in place for that thing to happen. If those conditions are not there, that thing won't happen. So usually when I write a talk, this is not a talk, it's a seminar, but usually when I prepare, I type everything and I print and everything comes really neat, you know, like proper list of things I'm going to say. But tonight, look at the mess. I wrote in bits of post-it everything I want to say, which gives some characteristics to this talk. One is that I might have lost some bits of talk in my bag. No? Let's hope not. It might also happen that I, halfway through, I change my mind and decide to change the order of the post-its, as I did several times before coming here. So this talk hasn't got a kind of fixed form or fixed essence. You know, it's not completely set on stone, and it wouldn't happen exactly like, it might not happen exactly like this. So it hasn't got any fixed essence. What may happen is that you might think, God, I really like things to be very well structured, so I'm not going to like this. So that might not be very satisfactory if you have that kind of mind. Or you might think, oh great, I really like things to be spontaneous and alive and messy, I really don't mind that at all. In that case, it will be satisfactory, but you might be sad when the talk ends. So you might end up feeling a bit disappointed either during the talk or after the talk. And another characteristic of this talk is that it will end. Under no circumstances I'll be talking forever. So you're looking at three characteristics here of this talk. One is that it hasn't got anything fixed in there, that it will be there no matter what. It might not be satisfactory, and it will definitely end. And these are exactly the three characteristics of everything that is conditioned, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So I could finish the talk here, but I've got lots of post-its to cover, so I'll go on for a while. So I'm talking about, this is based on chapter 7 of the book, loosely based also, because I don't want to say exactly what Devan said, because that gives you an opportunity to buy the book and learn much more from him. And also because I like bring examples that actually relate to my own experience. And maybe we can also bring up examples that relate to your experience. That's going to be even more interesting for you. For me too, actually. So the chapter is called The Nature of Existence. Now, Bhante Sangharakshita once gave a talk, I can't remember when, in the 60s, I think, when he says that nature of existence, nature is a very abstract term. And because Buddhism really puts a lot of effort and focus on describing things based on our own experience, when he gave that talk, he preferred the word texture, the texture of existence, which I find a very interesting term, because when we talk about texture, it's almost tactile, isn't it? The texture of this jumper is different than the texture of this velvet mat. But it's that kind of curiosity that I would like us to develop here, explore here, in relation to everything that exists, everything that is conditioned. So these three marks I mentioned in relation to the talk, which are very fitting because it's a conditioned talk, they're also called the three lakshanas. Lakshanas is a Sanskrit term that means mark. Devan, who wrote the book, also thought, he refers to lakanas, which is, I haven't got a clue how to pronounce this, but it's the same word, and it's only that it's in Pali, not Sanskrit. So we're talking about the three lakanas or lakshanas, or the three characteristics, or the three marks of everything that is conditioned, means everything we know. It's a really, really old teaching. It can be found literally in the Dhammapada, which is one of the oldest pieces of scriptures that that we know, if not the oldest. Does anyone know if it's the oldest?
I don't think it is.
No, but pretty old, isn't it? But what I mean by old is that it was when the Buddha was around, there was no written language, so all the teachings were transmitted verbally. But then at one point people start writing them when, you know, writing was a bit more developed. So this is one of the first ones that got actually written. So the three marks I talked about, can anyone still remember them?
Yes.
You don't count. But it's all right. Okay, come on, Angela, did you say...
Impermanence.
Yeah.
This is essentiality.
Yeah.
Unsatisfactory.
So I could also tell you the Pali names for that, but I'll say it later. So there are different ways of teaching them, and I particularly like starting with dukkha. Dukkha is unsatisfactoriness. So the Pali word for that is dukkha. Dukkha is a term that comes from the literal translation is something to do with an ill-fitting will. So it's a will that is not properly fitted, you know. So this relates to, you know, in the time of the Buddha, people would use chariots. So a chariot with a will that is not very, you know, well fitted, and then in a usually not very good road in India, that would make for a really uncomfortable journey, you know, like with a wheel not working well. I've never been on a chariot, but I know, for example, if I go to Tesco, usually I get a trolley with a well-fitted wheel, and it's pretty annoying because it wants to go somewhere and the trolley goes somewhere else. So it's that kind of... It's usually dukkha is translated as suffering, but it also relates to that kind of things are just not perfect. You know, they're not something that is not quite smooth. It's a bumpy ride. So some people, when they talk about Buddhism, they say, "Oh, are you Buddhist? Poor you! You know, Buddhist is all about life is all suffering, isn't it?" They said, well, actually, something that says life is only suffering, or if it's all suffering, wouldn't really attract me being the hedonist I am. So life is all suffering. It's not exactly what Buddhism is relating to. You could think more like life is a bumpy ride, or life is not perfect. Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
So there are many ways of discussing dukkha. Divan in his book discusses three kinds of dukkha, which I'll just say it so you know you might read the book later on. I'm going to mention another list of ways of classifying dukkha. The Buddha said there are seven kinds of dukkha. One is birth. Birth is painful, so brings pain to it. It's not completely... Well, now I'm getting confused here because I'm talking about dukkha as being something that is not satisfactory, or it could be painful, it could be suffering. So these are all kind of different nuances of the word dukkha. So birth is a kind of dukkha that even involves physical pain, to the mom at least. Sickness, and I can tell you that firsthand, you know, having a cold and not feeling very well. Old age, I can also tell you firsthand, it's going to get much worse, but it's already getting a bit kind of disappointing. Death is something that most of the times involves also some suffering and pain. And so those were four kinds of dukkha. There is then contact with what one dislikes. So any example of contact with something you dislike?
Porridge.
Porridge. Okay, sorry, what did you say, Ben?
Work colleagues.
Okay. Any other... Does anyone want to share another dukkha related to... contact with things you don't like?
Tube trouble,
all right.
The mess in your room,
okay. These are all things that you can change, by the way. Not sure about the porridge, though. Another kind of dukkha is separation from what one likes. So, examples? Oh, so you're separating from that sense of ease and relaxation.
Having a lot of time for yourself to choose what to do. Having to get up, because you have to get up at that time, whether you like it or not.
Okay, so that is something that happens often, isn't it? Having to wake up and go to work and not enjoying it. Another one, the last one from this list, is not to get what one wants. You are so much fighting to share that I don't know who to choose. Okay, no one wants to share that. Okay, fine, I get it. I'm not getting what I want. Which was just one example or two.
Pay rise.
A pay rise, thank you. So you really would like a pay rise, you don't get it. You feel that kind of dukkha. There was no cake left. I'm so sorry.
I made the cake and I got home and there was no cake left.
Okay. Did you make it out of generosity?
Yeah, but I kind of expected to get some.
Oh, so you've got a bit of mixed motives there in your, you know, your good karma there of making it out of generosity. All right then. Expectations usually lead to dukkha. So, but as I said before, it's not that there is only dukkha. Some experiences are actually pleasant. So some things can be very pleasant. The problem is they end. And then it won't be pleasant when the pleasant experience ends. Bhante says that there is a degree of spiritual maturity in seeing that even pleasant conditioned experiences involve some concealed suffering. So there is some hidden suffering. Even in a pleasant experience, there might be some hidden suffering. And not only related because... related with the end of the experience. So, for example, your own pleasure may involve the suffering for someone else. So I'm going to give examples myself, and they're all based on chocolate. I know, Yanavacha usually talks about mangoes, I talk about chocolate. So, if I buy a chocolate that is not fair trade, that might mean that because I want to buy that chocolate, I'm supporting an industry that is actually creating suffering for other people, you know, not very fair working conditions. Do I think of that when I buy a chocolate? Unfortunately, not always. And it would be good if I could think of that. Another kind of hidden dukkha is that pleasant experiences it may include anxiety because you're afraid of losing it. So sometimes some people give me a big bar of chocolate. Even while I'm kind of halfway through it, I'm already kind of anxious. It's going to end. I might get, you know, need to get more and more bits, because otherwise other people are going to get my chocolate and it will end, and I don't want it to end. So instead of just, you know, enjoying my chocolate, I'm already thinking about when it will end. Or something pleasant which is binds one to something else that brings about suffering. Well, that's how, let me explain better. Maybe there's something that you think is pleasurable, but actually it's not completely pleasurable and brings about something else that is unpleasant, and you can't see the connection. So if I eat lots of chocolate, I might get very sick at the end, I might put on weight, and there are lots of things I don't like, but they are there because I could only see the pleasure of eating that bar of chocolate. Then there is also the pleasure from conditioned things that cannot satisfy the deepest longings of the heart. And I think that is probably the most important hidden dukkha, is that no matter how much chocolate I eat, you know, that won't really satisfy my heart. Because we're just talking about a bit of chocolate, basically. And it's a bit of fat and sugar and cocoa. It doesn't really compare to that kind of happiness and satisfaction I might experience if I am on a good meditation seat and feel really open mind, you know, and open-minded and loving towards others. But I don't remember that when I want to eat a bar of chocolate. There are many other examples. I let you to think about them in your own experience. Look at everything you really like, what you think is really pleasant, and just reflect a little bit on what is it behind it that might not be as pleasant as you think it is. So that's all for dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. So this other mark, or that's all for tonight. Obviously, I could talk for a whole, you know, 3 months on dukkha, and we still would have a lot to talk about. And if you want to ask questions later, it's fine. But I'm going to move now to the second mark of conditioned things, which is that of being impermanent, and they all end. So if the conditioned things end, the word in Pali for that is anicca, or in Sanskrit is anicca, which sounds very similar, but you spell in different ways. So that is easy, isn't it? Everything ends. So does anyone have any question with that? Does anyone dispute that?
You can see that in the leaves at the moment, where they're green in the middle and then they go out yellow and then they go into brown and they look very dramatic, multicolored.
Oh, I'm happy you mentioned the leaves, because I'm going to talk about leaves later on. So, but you mean they're not permanent then, the leaves?
No, you can even see the impermanence on the leaves, especially a plane tree leaf.
And you can see it visually, I mean the colours.
changes. Yes, it's very dramatic, almost artistic.
Okay, so Ben is in favor of impermanence. Is anyone against? Okay, so intellectually we all understand that, don't we? Fine, we could go to the third lakshana now. Because intellectually it's fine to understand impermanence. It's so obvious. Everything that is conditioned, or another word for that is compounded, you know, made of parts of conditions of other things. One day these things will kind of not be together anymore, and that thing won't exist. It will be reduced to its parts again, so the leaves Ben is talking about will just be reduced to whatever leaves are reduced to, some organic matter that will look like compost of some kind. Now, emotionally, it's much more difficult to look at impermanence. Say, for example, you are in love. Can you remember that love will end? It's getting a bit gloomy, isn't it? Or say, for example, you've got a broken heart. Just let's go deeper in this. Let's get a bit sad here. Say you've got a broken heart. Can you remember that actually that heart will probably reasonably healed and you have a normal life after some time? Have you ever been there? Mm. I have.
I think if you've had a broken heart before, then yeah, because like when it happens again, you remember that like when this happened originally, you thought you would die, but actually here you are and you didn't die.
Yeah.
So probably this time you won't die either.
Yes.
I mean, that's my experience of it.
Thank you, Karen. That shows perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, but I had to go through the appalling misery of thinking I was going to die in order to learn that in actual fact you don't.
Yes. And
I've never been that miserable since.
Yeah.
Although I have had my heart broken yet again since. And it does seem to be the case that
Yes. Things
in fact are impermanent. Mm.
And even putting that in perspective, which was a very helpful example, it still hurts. Isn't it? There is some pain there.
Yes, but I think like this gentleman over here was saying, that's, you just need to accept that is the nature of existence, you know. Some of it is pleasant and some of it is painful, and that's the way it is. There's no need to kind of get overly attached to either the pleasure or the pain, really. Because I have learned since coming here, in fact.
You said in a sort of slightly jokey way, is everyone in favour of impermanence earlier on? And I just thought, well, actually that's interesting, that statement, because I am in favour of impermanence.
Of impermanence or permanence?
Yes, impermanence. Mm. Because I think it adds to that connection you have with something. Mm. If it's something beautiful, like those lilies going to die. Mm. But if they're going to be like that forever, you sort of take it for granted, don't you?
Yeah.
But those particular lilies are going to die in a few days' time.
Mm.
And so you relish the beauty
yeah.
as a result of that.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. It's a moving example, and a great deal of poetry has been written on that.
Yeah.
On those lines, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
Things that are beautiful and will just go. And actually, beauty and loss is so...
Yes.
They so much relates to each other.
But the difficulty, of course, is the more painful things.
Mm.
You know, I'm not sure I have the same feeling about the pain bit, relishing that, because it's impermanent. I kind of push it away.
Mm.
Anyway.
Okay, thank you for that.
They say that statistically it's 3 years average to heal a broken heart.
Really?
What about slightly chipped?
Well, it was an American scientific.
Okay. Well, we'll go back to the Dharma. If you know, this is very interesting, but I'll come back here too. We're talking about impermanence, so things change. It's interesting that quantum physics is kind of saying something similar at the moment. The Buddha said it 2,500 years ago, but now our scientists managed to catch up with all this. So instead of talking about indestructible atoms, you know, as we believed at one point, that they were there forever, and they would just be, you know, binding to each other, and then they will create things, but they were there forever. Instead, scientists now are talking about everything just being a process, and you don't know exactly how these particles, just the subatomic particles, just come and go in a variety of very complicated ways that I will not try to bluff my way through, even if I used to be a physicist. But you've got that idea that even now we are getting to this same understanding that things are not there forever. And the whole universe, for example, the whole universe, I don't know if you saw that famous Wonders of the Universe a few months ago, you know, universe, stars being formed, universe being formed, all terribly dramatic and beautiful. And, the whole universe is this vast network of processes in different types, at different levels, and they're all interrelated all the time. So things are just happening and happening and happening. And there is nothing there that is fixed forever. So we're talking here about impermanence of matter, which we seem to agree. There is also impermanence of mind. So Karin, for example, gave the example of a broken heart that can move, and Ben said will probably take 3 years or so in average. So we're also talking about that other kind of impermanence, which is fine, because as we saw last week, on a level of the mind level, the citta niyama, the mind, the things that happen in your mind are also conditioned, because they're conditioned, they're going to be impermanent. So I like when Bhante puts it very kind of in a very simple way in one sentence. He says, there is nothing unchanging in our internal experience of ourselves. Nothing is unchanging. Which in a way could be a bit scary, isn't it? What do you mean? Everything is changing all the time. I want some fixed ground here, you know, to know who I am. On the other hand, everything is changing. Great. I can then improve. I can, you know, I can expand my mind, my heart, whatever I want, you know, in whatever way I want to change things. I've got more freedom to change. So there we are, all of us here right now. We are this succession of mental states and feelings and perceptions. So you're looking at me talking, and then you look at someone else talking, and you hear, and so these are all perceptions and things that are going on and on and on all the time in your mind. You might be getting bored, you might be getting curious. This is all happening every moment. It's funny, isn't it? We think, the body is impermanent. We mentioned so much the impermanence of the body, but actually the mind is changing so much quicker than the body. At least mine does, you know, the body's changing pretty quickly, but the mind changes in a complete different pace. So I don't know if you remember, we mentioned the wheel of life. And for those who are here when we talked about the wheel of life, there was that nice complex drawing with that monster, you know, kind of fun thing, holding it. I hope I didn't look like the monster, by the way. You remember, holding the thing. So that monster was the monster of impermanence. So all conditioned things are impermanent. So we even got a picture of impermanence. And I really like, I can't remember where I read this or if I wrote it myself, I probably didn't, but I came across this quote that really summarizes the whole thing for me. which is that the problem is not with impermanence. Impermanence is fine. So we don't suffer because things are impermanent. We suffer because we want some things to be permanent. So it's a big difference there. The root is not the impermanence. The root of this dukkha is not in the impermanence itself. It's in our desire for things to be, for certain things to be permanent. Yeah? No? Please say yes.
Well, yes, I agree. But if you think it, if you keep thinking it through, do you not then come to the conclusion that actually you don't desire to be? I don't know.
Well, I don't know, Andy. There are things I do want to be permanent, and I believe they are permanent.
Like, for instance,
but on a completely rational level.
You want to live forever, but do you want to live forever?
No.
Okay.
No.
But I think people do want to live forever, but I think people don't want to die. Nobody wants to get old because it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Basically, things don't work properly.
But that comes with the deal, doesn't it?
So I think what you were saying is that the problem is not with the way things are. The problem is that things aren't the way we want them to be.
Exactly. That's what I tried to say, yes.
That's like, we don't suffer because of the way things are, we suffer because things aren't the way we want them to be. And how we want them to be is, like, we do want our relationships to last forever, and we do want to not...
Well, we think we do, because I remember being in a relationship 20 years ago, and I thought, if only a genie could appear, you know those genies from appear from a lamp and ask me, what do you want? And I would have said, I want this relationship to go forever. Now I'm so pleased I didn't have any gene at that time, because I would be stuck in a relationship. Yeah.
But maybe it's the feeling that you, the feeling of pleasure that that you associated with the relationship that you wanted to last forever. So that feeling of pleasure you wanted to last forever.
Mm. That's true. Change boyfriends and keep the same feeling. Yes.
But that's seeing that the pleasure is separate from the conditions that give rise to it.
I think it's because change is frightening. Like, the thought of it is more scary. We were talking about this earlier, and I think people want things to stay the same even when they're unsatisfactory, because the thought of them being different is more scary than continuing the same unsatisfactoriness. Is that scary?
You're nodding there. You relate to that.
It's not, I think it's not the change, it's the unknown. Like, it's not great now, but oh my gosh, it could be worse. That's scary.
James?
I think there's something in what you were saying about levels of consciousness as well. So we might think, you know, we might not think really that we want to live forever, but something in us wants, you know, like you're saying, doesn't want to get old. Or so, for example, I was reflecting a bit on my own experience recently, where I was thinking about my life as it was 10 years ago. And it was interesting, because when I read through journals from that time, I was having just as difficult a time in some ways as I am now. In fact, I'm probably happier now overall. But I look back on that time with really rose-tinted specs. And then suddenly the penny dropped that actually it wasn't that I wanted that experience, but just I wanted to be the me of now, but 10 years younger.
Just
all the things that being in my late 20s brought.
Yeah.
But I couldn't access the clarity of that without a lot of reflection. And that was when it hit me, and I thought, actually, that's just going on some deeper level that I don't always have access to.
Yeah.
Is this resistance to getting older. And even though I'm actually happier and more content in myself now, something in me really doesn't like aging.
Yeah.
Because it means the closer to death, and we don't want to die.
Yeah. And also just the thing of, you know, I'm not as fit as I was, and I've got grey hair and balding,
It's terrible.
All right. But thank you. It's a very good example. Who would like to be a teenager again?
No,
it was horrible. But now, I'll just repeat the actual verses of this teaching of conditionality that is called Paticca Samuppada. And one of the formulations says, those things conditionally arisen, the realized one, means the Buddha, the realized one has told their cause. And the ceasing of them too, this is the great renouncer's teaching. So he told the causes of that makes things arise and cease. Another traditional formulation of this teaching is this being that becomes, from the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not become, from the ceasing of this that ceases. So one thing I notice with these verses is that they talk a lot, that both of them talk about things arising and then ceasing. And I think one tends to focus either on the arising bit or the ceasing bit. You know, he said that we've got these two tendencies. I personally love the arising and don't like the ceasing. Some people don't care much about the arising and really focusing on things that are just about to end and everything is ending, so why the fuss, why bother, everything is ending anyway. So we are talking here about two tendencies, and in these two different ends of the same dimension. So one is eternalism and the other one is, I never know how to say that, I used to say nihilism. Divan says annihilationism. Does that make sense? Annihilationism?
Annihilationism.
No, there are more syllables in there. Annihilationism. Anyway, you got the idea. Some people focus on what is coming up, on things being eternal, and other people focus on things not being there at all. So it's interesting for you to kind of just look at your experience. You know, what is your tendency? Or might be that your tendency is one for some things and another one for other things. So eternalism, and these were two wrong views that were wrong views because they are not exactly as reality is. Nothing is there forever, but it doesn't mean that nothing exists. So they're not really. They're both a kind of distorted view, and the Buddha, and they were very much around at the time of the Buddha. So when you talk about eternalism, there is one term that was very much used in India at that time, and that is Atman. And Atman means the core of subjective self-awareness. So it's something like being, you know, something that really defines your being that you've got inside yourself. And that was considered to be unchanging, you know, that is your essence and will be there no matter what, and it doesn't change. And when you die, then your body disintegrates in some way, probably being cremated in India, and then this core subjective experience will pass to another new body. So that unchanging subjectivity would survive the death of your body. Now the other ones, the nihilists, nihilists, whatever, they're much more materialistic. And in a way, it is a view that is very much, when you talk about scientific materialism and all that, in the West here, it's very much what relates to that view. So that view is that we are physical beings, and when we die, that's it. Nothing survives it. Nothing survives the death of your body. There's nothing that goes anywhere else. So there are two complete different opposite poles. So one is focusing on things becoming, the other one on things ceasing. But actually, the becoming and the ceasing, the arising and the ceasing, they're just two sides of exactly the same coin. You can't have one without the other. They are, they are really the same thing. It's just this, which side you're looking at. And I always find that difficult to explain, difficult to understand and difficult to explain. So it's good if you just reflect a bit in your own time, you know, to see how you can express that with your own words. But going back to Ben's leaf, that is usually the traditional way of explaining impermanence, at least when I started coming to this center, was exactly the one of the leaf. Because it's great, isn't it? It happens every autumn that the leaves die. So it's this example of impermanence when you talk about a leaf that grows, and then it's a leaf there, and then ends, you know, falls and becomes compost of some kind. And because I'm always thinking about things either arising or either ceasing, but I can't see them as being one thing only, I would imagine, I would understand it as the example as being you've got something that is growing and becomes a leaf, and then it's a leaf for some time until autumn comes, and then it ceases to be a leaf. But that's not right either. It's not that thing was a leaf. Well, it was a leaf because we decided to call that thing that is growing and changing color every day. We decided to, when it has a certain shape, we call it a leaf. So in a way, it's useful for us to communicate with each other. I can say, oh, nice leaf there, instead of saying, nice process that is from some biological nature and it's growing. At the moment it's green and it will be brown in a few, you know, weeks. So in a way it's helpful to give names to things. But when we're giving names to things, we might just have this fixed idea that there they are, and they happen to become, and they are, and then they will cease. It's not really how things are. It's not that helpful thinking of things like that. And I could think that of me too. You know, there I was, a baby, a little girl, teenager, blah, blah. I grew. Then I became me, which probably means adult. And being me for a long time. And now I'm kind of noticeably starting to cease to be. I mean, at least parts of me are definitely not as they used to. But that is wrong. That is wrong. I've been in this process my whole life. There wasn't a time when I was me and changing. All the time I've been changing. All the time this leaf that is there has been changing. All the time this flower has been changing. We might call it a flower, a leaf, or lilamani. But these things are changing all the time. So I used to think we change, like I change around the edges, you know, that's not true. It's not that I change, I am change. It's not that we change, we are change, we are a process. Pause to breathe, take that in.
I think, you know, somebody will probably know if I'm slightly inaccurate, but I think like every cell in your body is replaced like every 7 years, isn't it? So, what's you then?
And we're talking about the matter,
yeah,
but, and there is also how about
atoms, my molecules and things, yeah, that make up the,
yeah,
that is all different every 7 years.
And also my mind. If I compare my mind now to my mind 7 years ago, it's a lot different. Hopefully improved, but, you know, not on all accounts.
Is not this idea of arising and ceasing something to do with our notion of time? Because if we think this seminar starts at 7:15 and finishes at 9:45, then we've got a very different idea that something is finishing. But it's not really. I mean, you might still be talking, but to somebody else. You might not be talking to everybody, and you're going to get up and move about in different ways. But it's just something else is starting. Or you could just say there's nothing really starting or finishing. So really, it's the function of time. This idea of time is very fixing things, you know?
Which, in a way, could be good when I say, well, the seminar will end at 9:45, so you know what time you're likely to leave the centre and go home. So it has its utility, but doesn't really reflect what goes on. Here we're talking about a process of exploring and discussing this idea of conditionality. I don't know when Devon started writing the book, but we decided to base it on the book, but also the things Devon wrote about have been discussed for 2,500 years ago. When did it start, you know, this seminar?
I think that's a good point you've made. I think consciousness and time are so interwoven, and one doesn't exist perhaps without the other, I think. And we make sense of our experience through this notion of time. So ceasing and things coming into existence and ceasing is a sense, is a sort of cycle of time, is a cycle of consciousness.
Well, I think it really would like... I agree with you, but what I really want to emphasize here is that the ceasing and the arising and the ceasing are actually, they're just one.
Yes. But there's another aspect to the time thing, in that we'll each be experiencing this time differently. If we're really enjoying it, it will kind of be flying by. Yes. If you're kind of sort of thinking, oh, I could do with the toilet or too hot in here, you know, whatever, the time seems really long. So it, you know, so our construct of time is dependent upon conditions.
That is really true when you're meditating. Sometimes it seems like a really short period of time, and other times it seems like it's been like an hour. Mm-hmm. And it's always pretty much the same period of time, but it how it feels is completely different.
Even the measure itself as well, with time, we've got that. Anybody, as you know, in science, I mean, they have sent clocks, you know, set two very accurate clocks, send one up into space, and when it comes back, it is actually a different time, because it's the spin, as far as I understand it, which is probably not that well, but the spinning of the Earth and gravity, and then the movement of that going around the sun creates time in the way that we measure and understand. But if you change those conditions, then that measured form of time itself actually changes.
I'm really interested in this conversation. I'm just worried about time. Seriously. And I'm on a dilemma here, because in a way I want to continue with this, but I'm also aware I still need to talk about the third characteristic, and we only got 15 minutes. And that is the kind of more, even more complex one to talk about. So I really enjoyed it, but if you don't mind, going through the rest of the material. Just to go back to what I was saying about ceasing and arising and ceasing being the same, there is one quote from Bhante Sankaracharya from the book The Three Jewels, and he says, seeing conditioned things as impermanent does not mean seeing them first as actually existing and afterwards as no longer existing, but rather in reducing them to an absolutely continuous flow or pure becoming, in connection with which the terms being and non-being are meaningless. Did you get the idea? So it's not that things exist and then don't exist. Mm-hmm. There's just a flow. So, a bit of poetry here. And you probably know this. It's one of my favorite bits of the Dhamma. As stars, a fault of vision, as a lamp, a mock show, dewdrops, or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. So how is it that you see a bubble? What happens when you see a bubble? How long is a bubble there for? It's a serious question.
Some bubbles are there for longer than others.
Okay, in average.
Not very long.
Not very long. A lightning flash.
3 seconds, according
Thank you. I knew it was a lightning flash. How long is that there for? Okay, a cloud. Imagine you're seeing a cloud, you know, changing. What happens when you see a cloud? Huh? I just see it changing and changing all the time. I think it looks like something and then looks like something else. So what I would like you to do now is just spend, and I'll count, 1 minute looking at everything around you, looking at each other, and just remembering this. We're looking at each other as if we are just a lightning flash, a bubble, a cloud, because that's true. So just very much let that sink in. Everything here in this room is impermanent. One day these walls are going to crumble. Those candles are about to end much earlier than the walls, I hope. We are all going to die. Just look at each other and think about that. We are all going to die.
That's very strong, isn't it? That's very strong, putting it like that.
Well, why do we take so much trouble now?
Trouble to do what?
Bother, you mean?
Yeah, why bother?
Why bother?
You know, we come here, we talk, we do this, we try and...
Because you can change?
Why do any of this? Why take the trouble?
Yeah,
why not just go eat, drink, and...
Would that make you happier than feeling that others really matter? Well, for me personally, I get more satisfaction out of connection and valuing everyone's being and every drop of life, more than a pint, actually, even more than a bar of chocolate.
But it's interesting you say that, because some people do go into that why bother mode, don't they?
Yeah.
End up, I mean, that it could manifest in all kinds of ways. They could just obliterate themselves through intoxications of some sort, become very depressed. Some people are very positive and keep going, you know. Some people just, you know, dramatists write about it as the.
I think you're talking here also again about that view of being a nihilist, you know, like, oh, it's all going to end,
yes.
So let's just go to the first pub and. Then great, you know.
Also,
which is not great.
In the Buddhist view, we can change and become more.
Yes.
And, you know, so in the Buddhist view, we can become enlightened. So we kind of go beyond change, we go beyond, we you know, sort of enter the deathless, we become into a state which is kind of beyond change in a certain way.
And I was, I really like the mysterious flavor of that. What is he talking about? There is this beautiful mystery.
I'm
we don't
just
know.
Just wrestling with the phrase beyond change.
Yeah. Okay.
What you mean is you become not impermanent. If impermanence is change, but beyond change, that means I'm no longer, as if the Buddha no longer impermanent.
Karen, if you buy the book, there is a long discussion on that.
That goes back to a duality, though. It's so hard to get out of thinking in duality, permanent and impermanent.
And you and us and all this. I mean, you've been very good, I think, at making this connection between the fact that arising and ceasing is the same coin. Mm-hmm. And that just, if it's all process, then that helps me anyway understand that I'm actually not a separate entity. And actually this whole notion of us existing or not existing is a bit less worrying, because we don't exist as an entity anyway, we're just a process.
Yeah, and it's important to see how you change emotionally with that understanding. I'll just move on. again, I'm really interested in what Dayabhadra brought in and how you responded to this. But I'll just move on to the third mark or characteristic of existence, and that is insubstantiality, which is one translation for the word anatta. So it could be translated as insubstantiality, or without self, or emptiness of self, or emptiness of essential being, or having no permanent identity. So there are lots of different translations. So let's just play a bit with this idea. What exactly is this? I mentioned before that Atman, which was the idea of a core subjective experience that never changes, and it's there no matter what, and won't change. So this is the negation of that. I mean, there isn't. This mark of existence is saying that this characteristic of existence, of conditioned things, is saying that there isn't that essential thing that won't change no matter what. Everything can change, and there isn't an unchanging self. And then we get into a very interesting discussion about, well, there is no self. Well, I'm experiencing myself here. What do you mean there is no self? You know, I know what I'm feeling, you know, I know what the emotions that I've got, so I've got a self. Well, I have an experience, an illusion of a self, but that is changing all the time. And it's not, it wouldn't be there no matter what. So there are these things. First, it can't just originate out of itself. My sense of self originates based on tons of conditions, including having a body, a consciousness, volitions. But and also, so not only can't originate itself, it depends on conditions, but it also is changing all the time. It's not permanent, as it's not unchanging. So one thing Bhante says is because things are impermanent, they can be taken away from us. They can end, you know, we're not going to have them forever. So because things are impermanent, they can be taken away from us. What can be taken away from us is not our own. If it was really mine, no one would take it away. And what is not our own cannot be regarded as ourselves. So do you get the idea? I mean, we haven't really got that. So we've got this idea that we've got a self or an ego, and that will never change. Dayabhadra, could you please read that bit on ego from the book? It's a quote from Bhante, but it's in Devan's book.
The ego is no more than the tendency to absolutize one's present state of being. It is not a thing, but a faulty interpretation. The individual is there in a process of continuous change, and therefore of ever-present potential development. Delusion may also be there in the form of a belief in a fixed, unchanging self, or essence, or soul. But that fixed, unchanging self, or essence, or soul, or ego, is not there. It never was, and it never will be. And because it isn't there, one can't do anything with it, get rid of it, go beyond it, or whatever. The best thing to do as far as the ego is concerned is just to forget about it.
So do you get the idea what Bhante is talking about? I mean, it's not something that is fixed there, it will be there no matter what. It's just a collection of experiences. And I got about 2 minutes to finish this, so I didn't manage to talk about the 5 skandhas, or the 5 heaps, or the 5 khandhas, but it's a very traditional formulation in the Dharma, and I trust we'll be able to discuss it some other time. But it's the idea that what we are calling us, self, is actually a collection. There are a collection of things that relate to my body, and it's not just one body, one thing. Lots of different bits of body or anything that is physical. There is a collection of things that I call my volition, for example, which are my habits. That of, I really believe I love chocolate, and I'll keep believing on that. You know, just. Or just the way I respond to things emotionally, and there are heaps of, so there are five different kind of heaps or collectives of events, and I'm not sure I'm explaining this in a clear way, but I really, it's a way of explaining how we actually are. We are these bunches of things that relate to consciousness, volition, feelings, form was the body, and I forgot, anyway.
Perception.
Sorry?
Perception.
Perception, thank you. The way we perceive things. So that's what we are. You know, we are not a kind of, there is some continuity. You know, the person I was yesterday who liked chocolate, I still like chocolate, I might not like chocolate tomorrow, but there is some continuity there. So there is a continuity, but things are not fixed. And one example I've got, just really to finish here, it's something I saw once, just to finish with a more kind of poetic image, not really poetic, but just an image. When you see a fountain, so the other day I saw a fountain, so there was this bunch of water that was coming and flowing to the sides. It looked a bit like an umbrella made of water. It looked beautiful. It really looked solid.
Mm.
You know, there was a shape, and then there was a bit of a breeze, and the thing moved a bit. So there was this continuity. It didn't kind of disintegrate in drops of water. You know. It kind of kept its shape. And there it is, and really looked solid. But it was not. I knew that was a constant flow of water with all these tiny, tiny bits of drops of water just linked enough to create this illusion of something that has a form.
Mm.
So that's how, that's what we mean by something being, not having a fixed self, but still pretending it's a self, you know, looking like. You wanted to say something there, Badr? Oh, no, I saw you had raised your hand. So, there are no time for questions, but I think we had lots of questions throughout the discussion. I would like to thank you very much for your participation, and I wished we did have more time to keep talking. So, next week, Divan is going to come and launch the book. So if you did buy it, if you have already bought it, do bring it so he can sign it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Travel well.